From California to Vermont, Indiana to Alaska, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a reliance on undependable alternative energy sources has placed part of the nation on the brink of an electricity shortage. Merrill Matthews from the Institute for Policy Innovation is here with details. The second Republican presidential debate was held at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. We get the real story on how the candidates fared from Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. President Joe Biden showed up on a United Auto Workers picket line, but do his policies match his pandering? Eric Boehm from Reason Magazine has the answer. And many states have substantially underfunded public employee pension systems. Ideologically driven investment policies are making the problem worse. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Wind and solar are good alternative sources of electrical power when they work, but they have proven to be undependable as the policy push away from fossil fuels outruns both technology and generating capacity. Here to discuss the issue is Merrill Matthews. He is resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation based in Dallas, Texas. Merrill, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Merrill, we talk about the reliability and affordability of alternative energy sources, and today we're going to specifically be referencing wind and solar power. You are based in Texas, the Lone Star State, and in early September, there was almost an energy crisis. What happened?
Well, we had a very hot summer. It's not unusual for us to have a very hot summer in Texas, but that carried over into early September. And what happens in Texas is Texas has the largest wind production capacity of all the states. So if all the wind turbines are blowing, we get a fair amount of electricity from it. But in the summer, we get this heat dome that sits over a large part of the state usually, and it really shuts down the wind. The good news is that it also keeps the clouds away for the most part. And so solar activity can pick up to sort of offset some of the wind. But as you move into September and we start moving into the fall equinox, the sun's going down earlier. If it's still hot and the wind turbines are under that heat dome and they're not turning, you could have some several hours there in the late afternoon, early evening, in which you don't have enough capacity to power all the homes. So the ERCOT, our electricity grid, was issuing warnings there in September for people to conserve energy because it wasn't sure we were going to have enough to be able to keep all the lights on. So it got close a couple of times to having to do rolling blackouts in the state. It avoided that, but it was close.
Is this not a lesson for other states and for the country as a whole here, Merrill, that we're moving toward a reliance on alternative energy sources, but we're finding they aren't very reliable? Should this be an item of concern, an area of concern?
It should be an item of huge concern, because especially in areas like California, which are trying to force this expanded wind power, solar power, and so forth, it creates a real problem for them. Now, there have been some who said, well, if we just move some of these wind turbines offshore into the ocean, there's a lot of wind in the ocean, so they could pick that up. That certainly may be the case. However, we're a long ways from that. We've only got two. As much as people might hear about offshore wind, there's only two functioning wind farms out there in the country. There's a lot more set to go to start. But what they found now is that they're hitting what they're calling kind of a perfect storm of problems: rising interest rates, because these wind farms cost a lot of money, regulations that are problems, and then trying to connect to the grid has created a problem, and shortage of supplies, supply chain problems. And so the prices of the wind farms have been going up significantly, and now ratepayers, people who pay the electricity bills, consumers, are pushing back at the increases in price, and so the wind farms are saying we're going to need a lot more government subsidies in order to keep our prices low.
Let's talk a little bit about the impact of government regulations on even the ability to, as you put it, to build these wind farms offshore. But, Merrill, we're talking about adding all these electric vehicles to our vehicle fleet. The push is on by the Biden administration and the radical environmental left to convert our full fleet over to electricity. But you mentioned here at the start of the interview that there was almost rolling blackouts because of a lack of electric supply in Texas in early September. With all the regulations that prevent you from building transmission lines and power plants, how are we going to come up with the electricity to power all these EVs in addition to our normal use of electricity?
It's a very good point, Logan, because we do not have enough electricity generation in the country to power all the electric vehicles the Biden administration would like us to have. They're aware of it, and you know, there's other problems, of course, with being able to get your, if you're driving on a long trip and trying to get your EV powered up again through some kind of through a spot. But it is a real problem, and especially if we start moving towards using a large truck, tractor trailers that they want to try to turn into EVs, that is a real problem because those are huge energy hogs. And now California has proposed the notion that maybe they should have a system set up so that if the California energy grid is going down, they can suck energy out of the electric vehicles that are connected in order to help the grid. But then if you're in a wildfire and the state has just sucked out the energy from your EV and you want to try to escape the wildfire, you may not have the power to do that.
Are you getting the sense here, Merrill, that this whole scheme hasn't been very well thought out, that what we're seeing here is ideology moving way ahead of technological advances?
Absolutely is. This is the dream of the left and environmentalists to move us to renewable and clean energy, but it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of money, and we're a long, long ways from being able to achieve that. And so as a result, you're going to have fossil fuels around for a long time, and you've got an administration right now that just refuses to really concede that, and California and a few other states, by trying to force this before either the infrastructure is ready, that we have the technology, or consumers want it. Consumers just have not been willing to go out. You've got a handful of consumers who go out and buy electric vehicles, mostly Tesla, but you just haven't had consumers who are wanting to buy these cars yet. It's a government-mandated change that consumers or technology is not ready for yet.
Speaking of not being ready for, are you seeing additional roadblocks being put in place in order to curb the production of fossil fuels? Texas, of course, is a huge energy-producing state, but we've seen the cost of a barrel of oil skyrocket just within the last week or so. Is government regulation also constricting that supply at the same time as we don't have enough electricity to supply our electric needs?
Well, just recently, President Biden had taken land set up for energy production in Alaska, what we call ANWR, took that off the table. That's not going to be available. The companies, the fossil fuel companies, are trying to gear up and produce more oil and natural gas. And part of this is the restructuring of the supply lines because of the problems with Russia. Russia is now selling its oil and gas to China and other areas. So you've restructured sort of the markets out there, and that has made some countries more willing to buy from us and others less willing, and it has really riled the whole markets as they're trying to figure out how to change the energy markets in order to meet the changing structures of some of the countries out there that are just not our friends and are very aggressive in challenging us.
We have been talking with Merrill Matthews, who is a resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation. Merrill, tell us a bit about the Institute for Policy Innovation. Also, where can folks go? You've written extensively on this and many other related topics.
Sure. IPI is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research institute, commonly called a think tank, based in Dallas. And people can go to IPI.org.
Merrill Matthews from the Institute for Policy Innovation. Merrill, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. A lot of political news this past week with the second Republican presidential debate. And back on Capitol Hill, it appears we are headed for at least a partial government shutdown for a while. Much to talk about with Scott Parkinson. Good to have you here, Scott.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Well, you watched the presidential debate that took place on Wednesday night and interested in your thoughts as to how the various candidates performed.
Thanks for asking. This week, we had the second Republican presidential debate down at the Reagan Library in California. And there were seven candidates for president that attended. Obviously, the big news is that it's another debate that Donald Trump decided to skip. You know, he's way up in the polls nationally, and I think he's basically just viewing this as too much of an opportunity to be attacked by not just the media, but his opponents. And so he's basically set up all these sidebar events. First, he did an interview with Tucker Carlson, and this week he was in Michigan with the auto workers. And so it'll be interesting to see how long that's sustainable going forward. But we did have Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Vivek Ramaswamy, Chris Christie, Tim Scott, Mike Pence, and Doug Burgum participate in this debate. And it was really interesting, in my view, because kicking off the debate, you had a lot of conversation about what's going on the southern border. We've got an immigration crisis that's at hand. We know that in August, more people crossed illegally than any month in our nation's history. It was over 305,000 people. And so the Biden border crisis, I think, has turned into really a big, big issue in Republican politics. What do these candidates think about birthright citizenship and the 14th Amendment? What do these candidates think about what we're going to do with the people that have come over? What do they think about DACA? A lot of these economic situations with cheap labor. And so I think that was an interesting part of the debate. We also saw them really talk a lot about fentanyl and public safety crisis that's occurred due to really lax borders and just how much drugs that we catch and think about what we don't catch. Same thing with think about how many people we don't know are coming over. And so it is a crisis of sovereignty and border security, in my opinion. And I think that we obviously need a Republican that's going to adhere and take care of the rules on the books, the laws on the books right now. And that's obviously an abdication of duty from President Biden. And we saw a lot of crosstalk between DeSantis and Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy and Tim Scott. They were all getting after it. And it, to me, it seemed like the debate moderators had a really, really hard time, especially in the front end of the debate, controlling the outburst from the candidates. And when you're a candidate that's basically desperate for some sort of a moment, I'm not sure that it plays well with the American people to really almost be yelling over the top of one of your opponents. So that's a problem. The other big thing I thought was pretty interesting is the debate moderators really refused to engage Doug Burgum from North Dakota on the policy issues that he would say are in his wheelhouse, whether that's energy independence and sort of the energy boom we've had in North Dakota over the last decade or so, or also his experience in technology. There was a big question related to TikTok, and Burgum tried to get in there, and really the debate moderators refused to include him. The one question that they really gave him was related to agriculture, which is big for North Dakota, but agriculture, I think, is also big in Florida and all over the country. So I just thought it was interesting the way that Fox Business and Univision handled a lot of these questions, and ultimately just the fact that the person that's first in the polls has refused to engage in the debate process with the RNC and any of the media entities.
Well, we have one more debate scheduled for late November, I believe, so we'll see what develops between now and then. Meanwhile, Scott, back at Capitol Hill, the budget due October 1st. Here we are, 1st of October. No budget. What's happening there?
Well, we're getting close, at least close to some sort of a bipartisan agreement that might come to fruition. But, you know, when you have a lapse in government funding, the government still can operate essential operations. And when they do that, basically, if you're the head of the agency, you say, these are the workers and the work that they're doing that are essential to the core responsibilities of government. Now, the funding and the pay gets suspended, but that generally has been retroactively filled unless you're a defense contractor. And in the end, defense contractors are generally getting more money after the fact because we spend more money year after year after year. And we know we have a $2 trillion deficit. We have that border crisis I was talking about. The spending and national security issues related to immigration, I think, are what this fight has been about. Bidenomics is crushing the American middle class, and illegal immigration is jeopardizing American sovereignty and our national security. So I think this is an issue that the House conservatives have drawn the line in the sand for many, many weeks. And obviously Chuck Schumer and the Democrats and some of the Senate Republicans are starting to come forward saying, hey, we need to move forward and make sure we have a short-term extension to continue to fund our government. But there was a big problem this week because we continue to throw billions of dollars at Ukraine. And you've got senators like Rand Paul that don't want another dollar for Ukraine. So they objected to expediting any consideration of a continuing resolution this week.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Was President Joe Biden's appearance at a United Auto Workers picket line policy or pandering? We learn more from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
President Joe Biden traveled to Michigan on Tuesday, where he spoke in support of striking auto workers and became the first American president to walk a picket line. Now, the White House, of course, is framing this event as the ultimate show of solidarity from the famously pro-union president, but I see it a little bit differently. To me, it looks like Biden is pandering to the 1%. No, not the billionaire class, not the way we typically use that phrase, but the 1% of American workers who are unionized manufacturing workers. Yes, less than 1% of American workers are union members in manufacturing jobs. But boy, you would never know that by watching our politics, because on both the right and the left, politicians are falling over each other to appeal to this narrow sliver of the economy. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. You know, it's too soon to tell whether Biden's support for the union is going to have much of an effect on the impasse between the big three automakers and the United Auto Workers, the union that called the strike earlier this month. But politically, as I said before, the White House is framing this event as kind of the ultimate show of solidarity from Biden and the union. But I think that misses an important part of the story here. That is that 1%, that number I talked about earlier, because that's roughly the percentage of the American workforce that is unionized and employed in manufacturing. And far from being a kind of broad-based signal of support for blue-collar Americans, Biden's advocacy on behalf of the UAW this week is kind of just performative shilling for a real tiny sliver of the country's workers. In fact, the number is actually less than 1%. Now, Middlebury College political science professor Gary Winslet pointed this out in a nice Twitter thread this week, where he pulled a number of statistics here, and we're going to run through some of the important numbers for you. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, about 7.8% of American workers are employed in manufacturing jobs, and about 8% of manufacturing workers are members of a union. So you put those two numbers together and you end up with about 0.62% of America's workers that fit into both categories, unionized manufacturing workers. Now, that's still 842,000 people, which is, you know, nothing to sneeze at. But if the American labor force were visualized as, say, 1,000 workers, only six of them would be blue-collar manufacturing employees who are also members of a union. And again, I think this is something that you just would never think based on the way our politics works, the way our kind of political narratives around the economy operate right now. But that's a useful way of illustrating this huge disconnect between reality and our political rhetoric, which constantly equates the interests of unions with the interests of working class Americans, even though unionization rates have been falling for decades. These days, there are roughly seven times as many unionized workers in the public sector as there are in manufacturing jobs. That means that unions are far more likely to represent the interests of bureaucrats and public school teachers than the grunts on the assembly line. And to some extent, that reflects the overall decline in manufacturing jobs since labor unions' heyday in the mid-20th century, of course. But that's not all. It's not just a decline in manufacturing jobs. It also demonstrates how manufacturing work has shifted towards places that have lower rates of unionization. South Carolina, Tennessee and Alabama are now really the hotbed for American auto manufacturing, but most of the workers in those plants aren't unionized. They're not members of the UAW, although there is, in fairness, one plant in Alabama, I think just one, that is part of the current strike. Now, there's no indication either that the working public wants more union representation. There was a Gallup poll published last year in which just 11% of non-union workers said they were extremely interested in getting organized. Meanwhile, 58% of people in that poll said they were not interested at all in joining a union. But that same poll also indicates why Biden and, for that matter, Donald Trump are making these public displays of affection towards the UAW. According to Gallup, 71% of Americans have a favorable opinion of labor unions. That's the highest rating since 1965. So you've got a bit of a political conundrum here. On one hand, there's only a sliver of blue-collar workers who are members of unions. Most workers say they have little interest in joining a union, and it's no surprise that as a result, the number of people in unions is falling. Yet even as unions have dwindled as an economic force in America's manufacturing sector, they've enjoyed a surge of political support from voters who at least like the idea of labor unions, even if they've got little interest in actually joining one. We've kind of romanticized the idea of what a labor union is. It's similar, I think, in some ways to how we think about train travel. The public has these nostalgic and generally positive views about train travel, even though last year only something like 20 million people, that's well less than 10% of the country, rode Amtrak even once. Most of us wouldn't choose to join a labor union or travel by train over long distances, but we like the idea of both things existing. And as long as unions are giving off those good political vibes, politicians with abysmal approval ratings like Biden and like Trump are going to be falling over one another to be associated with those romantic notions. So I think that explains more about Biden's appearance in Michigan this week than anything else. It's almost like a religious pilgrimage rather than a serious commentary on the state of organized labor in the American economy. And of course, even though Biden has a First Amendment right to say and do whatever he'd like in this situation, I think it's pretty unseemly to have the country's chief executive picking sides in what is ultimately a private dispute between the automakers and their workers. But that's an issue for another day. Biden and his political advisors are surely convinced that this show of solidarity is an important thing for his reelection campaign. And that may very well be true, but this is a moment where a political truth might bear little resemblance to reality. Unionized manufacturing workers are just a tiny sliver of the American economy, but it seems that pandering to their demands is more politically important than ever before. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of what went on in Washington, D.C. and around the country this week, including our coverage of the big GOP debate on Wednesday night. All of that at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week for another edition of American Radio Journal.
Ideologically driven investment policies are making the critical underfunding of many states' public employee pension systems even worse. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Today, we will discuss an issue that's facing taxpayers and government workers across the state, and that is the unfunded pension liabilities in their state systems. Last week, my organization, the American Legislative Exchange Council, released our annual report, Unaccountable and Unaffordable. In its seventh edition, this report analyzed the unfunded pension liabilities for each and every state across America. And this year, those unfunded liabilities total nearly $7 trillion nationwide, which, of course, is an average of nearly $21,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. This issue of unfunded liabilities flies under the radar for most Americans, unfortunately, as we don't get a bill in the mail stating how much we must pay into the public pension fund. Instead, these unfunded liabilities take up a large amount of our tax dollars within state and local budgets, crowding out funding for essential public services and taking away opportunities for future tax relief. All 50 states have massive unfunded liabilities. The five states with the largest unfunded liabilities, however, are Connecticut, California, Hawaii, Illinois, and 50th out of 50, Alaska, ranging from anywhere from $34,000 per person upwards of $46,000 in Alaska. So these are truly massive numbers, our study revealed. Ultimately, states are in dire need of pension reform. So how did we get here? In addition to many of the significant policy challenges to government pension systems, such as state governments underfunding the systems and some big government politicians overpromising generous new benefits, a large and growing threat to pension plans and taxpayers is politically motivated investment schemes. Politically driven investments have been around for decades, but until recently, they haven't really taken on a level of prominence that they needed to be exposed in the form of an acronym that many of us have heard of that recently has become mainstream news. And that is thanks to the efforts of ALEC lawmakers and state financial officers across the nation to expose it, to it there being so-called environmental, social, and governance investing, or ESG investing. ESG, like previous iterations of politically motivated investing, has been around for some time, but has been used to punish politically, quote-unquote, unfavorable companies and industries by divesting from them. These strategies reduce investment returns over the long term, which leads to underfunding in the state pension plans across the country, with taxpayers ultimately footing the bill for these shortfalls. California, once again, playing the role of a state that always seems to show us what not to do, has left billions of dollars on the table in foregone investment returns thanks to politically motivated investment fads, like divesting their funds away from tobacco stocks more than 20 years ago. However, just because you may live in a state other than California, it doesn't mean your pension fund is safe from ESG and politically motivated investing. The largest of the proxy advisory firms, which guide institutional investors on how they should vote in corporate shareholder meetings, for instance, have increasingly pushed politically driven goals. One infamous case occurred recently over a proxy fight to replace four board members of ExxonMobil with Green New Deal-style activists, against the wishes of the company, of course. Institutional Shared Services, known by its acronym ISS, used its position as a proxy advisory firm to the Employees Retirement System of Texas and the Teachers Retirement System of Texas to recommend the pension systems vote in favor of replacing the board members at ExxonMobil. The systems both followed the recommendations of ISS, and three of the four board members of ExxonMobil were replaced by the Green New Deal-style anti-energy activists. And if this can happen with progressive anti-energy efforts in Texas, of all places, it can happen anywhere. To address these politically driven efforts that threaten pensions across the nation, a new ALEC piece of model policy was just released, the State Government Employee Retirement Protection Act. This model strengthens what we call fiduciary rules to keep politics out of pensions, requiring plan managers and proxy advisors alike to make decisions solely in the interest of financial returns for the retirees. With major pension reforms to protect against politically weaponized and chronically underperforming pensions, states continue to show that tackling big policy issues can be done successfully with real leadership, and it brings about the trusted policy solutions that we and ALEC continue to provide for all Americans. For more information, visit ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KADA-FM in Ada, Oklahoma, WTRV-FM in Walker, Michigan, along with WTWZ-FM in Jackson, Mississippi. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.